And so it is to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
We do not choose to be ruled. We elect to be governed.
In your heart, you know he's right.
Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bring you liberty, not destroy it. Evil the governments do lives after them. The good is often turned with their bones. So let it be with liberty in exile. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm your host, Yael Lasoski, broadcasting from the Freiheit Studio in Vienna, Austria, in the United States of Europe. This is the 25th day of February, 2011. Now, to those pensive minds and ears that have paid attention to this program now for the past year, you'll notice that we do have a change of scenery here at Liberty in Exile. We have moved the operation here to Wien, Österreich, right in the heart and center of Europe. Away from North America, the American Empire, and the Anglo-centric point of view. Of course, we'll always keep our status up, we'll always keep our focus on the stories that affect you, and we shall continue doing that from beginning until the very end, every week here on Liberty in Exile. Our website, as always, is libertyinexile.com. Many more updates brought to you, articles coming up, Twitter feed, blogs, links, videos, anything you need right there on the website. Now, while we've been away from this program, we have seen the revolutions of the world unite, mostly across all of Arab lands. And if you're interested in a little quick resume, I have one on the website, libertyinexile.com. It's the latest article, Pan-Arabian Revolution. Now we have Egypt, we had Algeria, we had Tunisia. Now we can add to the list Bahrain, Libya, even starting to see it in Iraq and Greece. But let us see, first off, the violence in Bahrain.
In Bahrain tonight, a victory for the protesters, but it is tenuous at best. Miguel Marquez there again tonight.
Score one for the protesters, a major victory. The government here blinked, allowing protesters to retake Pearl Square. An emotional and euphoric moment.
This is the moment that protesters have been waiting for. The military left this morning and then the police pulled out, and within minutes, thousands of protesters returned to this square to take back this symbolic piece of land, and they're handing out flowers.
Ambulance drivers who were fired on and beaten trying to pick up the wounded and the dead during days of violence were the heroes of this day. At today's start, Bahrain was on the cusp of civil war. The abrupt departure of all security forces from Pearl Square has brought the government here breathing room. Bahrain's crown prince took to the airwaves and promised to open negotiations with all sides.
Down, down, Khalifa!
The chant is down with Khalifa, down with the monarchy. The government here has a long way to go to satisfy these protesters. The violence here has hardened their demands. Last night, as these unarmed protesters walked toward Pearl Square, they were shot with rubber bullets. A horrifying scene. In the last week, nearly a dozen protesters have died, hundreds injured, and more than 60 are still missing. Tonight, these protesters are camping out once again on Pearl Square and say they won't leave till the monarchy allows full and free elections of the entire government. Anything less could once again bring Bahrain to the brink. Miguel Mar.
So that was Bahrain. That was the latest example. But of course, it started in Egypt, 25th of January, and now we're the 25th of February, 1 month later, and we see that the governments of Egypt have fallen. The government of Tunisia has fallen. There have been threats to protest almost all across the Middle East now. I was in Morocco. We had some in Algeria. We've had actually protests in Jordan, in Iraq, in Iran, and it's continuing. Now, I have some links up that are very interesting, and of course, you can't cover all of this because it's just too much. And, of course, the Western media is taking this one line where they're demonizing one people, one country. They're supporting another in another country they don't really know. And the truth is that the media was not prepared for this at all. Of course, you had Anderson Vanderbilt, who was very prepared, actually went himself to Egypt and was attacked by a mob. I wish I could have reported on that quicker, but apparently he was punched in the head 10 times, that's according to the Hollywood Reporter, and he was really in the thick of things with his crew. You try to watch the video, you don't really see him getting beaten up. Of course, that would be quite hilarious, but no, you see him right in the brisk, and you realize that when you're in a revolution, you can't just send cameras and crews and expect everyone to be friendly to you. The West has been intervening in the Middle East a long time. They're really not that favorable to us in the end. But that is one, and that was happening in Egypt. And of course, Mubarak is, well, he's lounging away not too far from here in a hospital right on the cusp of Vienna. I could go and visit him if I'd liked, but I believe I'd rather not. Of course, his assets, which were reported to be up to $70 billion, mostly in England, and apparently they were frozen. Who knows if he's had access? We can't really know. But there is a new government that is starting to negotiate now. You have different power grabs attempted by different coalition groups, and on and on. That's Egypt. Of course, the big focus right now, after Bahrain has fallen, Bahrain is very small, comparatively. There's not much to be gained for the United States by Bahrain's freedom, except that we do have a military base there. That always has to be thrown into the reports. They have to just say that, oh, yes, this is right. This is where the U.S. Army's base is. It's right in the middle of Bahrain. Hopefully that government, once it comes into power, it will kick the Americans out, but we shall see. But of course, now the focus, after Bahrain, after Algeria, after Tunisia, after Egypt, is Libya. Libya is the one place that has not yet fallen. And you've had Gaddafi. Gaddafi has been in power now for over 30 years. He's been continuously pushed and primed by the oil companies, riched up, fattened up. There have been many stories of the tales of BP in the area, and they've been giving a lot of business to Muammar Gaddafi. There's been many more oil companies. And basically, Libya, at least the aristocracy, has become very rich because of this. But the rest of the country, as is always the case, is near impoverished. And now that you see that Obama starting to come out, said the rights of Libyans are not negotiable. That was in a little speech that he gave, and that was really his first report. You have the Libyan people rising up, and I think the greatest reporting that we have right now is, of course, from the Marxist site Democracy Now. They actually have pretty good coverage there. They have reporters who are fully embedded. They speak the language, know the situation, know the people, know the political players. They have pretty very good reporting on that, and they've been reporting on that from the very beginning. They've had their own embedded folks, and you sort of see these people have been deprived. They've been deprived of the life that you and I enjoy. Is there a liberty in exile in Libya? I don't think so. Freedom of the press is not as it is here or across North America. Is there a liberty in exile in Egypt, in Algeria, in Bahrain, in Iraq? Perhaps. But it's being done at the tip of a gun, the threat of violence and of shutdown. We've seen in Bahrain, we've seen in Libya, the military have attacked the protesters. And in Libya, it's a special case. They're all mercenaries, foreign mercenaries from all over Africa that are being paid by Gaddafi to come and to guard the empire and guard the old state. But it shall not stand. The people are resonating. The people are coming together, and they're overthrowing their leaders and demanding the freedom they deserve. Now, a couple of little interesting tidbits that have been thrown out. Of course, Gaddafi came out and said that, according to the Daily Beast, Al-Qaeda is the one that has triggered the protest. This is coming from the Daily Beast. He said on Thursday on television that Al-Qaeda is behind the protests that have rocked the country and that have threatened to unseat him. He argued that ringleaders were loyal to Osama bin Laden and, in a warning to parents, said they'd recruited teenagers to join them by drugging them with hallucinogenic pills in their coffee with milk, like Nescafe. Oh, goodness. I'm sorry, I said earlier 30 years. He's actually been in power for 42 years. And now there's been reports that he's fled to Venezuela. I think those have been debunked. It's probably more likely that he is in Tripoli, the capital, where he has all of his mercenaries around him, but the rest of the country is up in the coalition groups. And there are a couple of stories that are interesting on Libya. There is an interesting one in the New York Times just this morning talking about anarchy and control. Because people always assume, have the assumption that anarchy, of course, you have people in the streets shooting each other, there will be no order at all. But here's the article here in Libya. Let me just read from this. The rebels here have said they caught a spy in the court building, the nerve center of the uprising, recording insurgent plans on a cell phone camera. The response was swift. Prosecutors interrogated the man on Thursday, and the rebels said they planned to detain him for now. We want to know if he's alone, said Fathir Terbel, the lawyer whose detention set off Libya's rebellion and is now one of its leaders. In the city where the Libyan uprising began, lawyers, prosecutors, judges, and average citizens who oppose the rule of Colonel Muammar el-Qaddafi are adjusting to unfamiliar roles. They are keepers both of an evolving rebellion as well as law and order in Libya's second largest city. And they fret that their gains will be reversed by people in groups sympathetic to Colonel Qaddafi, who still maintain a presence. Since Sunday, when government forces withdrew and Benghazi became the first major city to fall under rebel control, residents and rebels have been left to hammer out a new way of life and governance. And of course, the article goes on to talk about how the judges and the policemen all keep doing their job. Everything is still working as it was before. The institutions are there. People are peaceful, keeping the peace, guarding the neighborhoods. Of course, people always assume that it's going to be total chaos and anarchy, but of course, Libya is proving otherwise. Of course, another article has to do with Iraqis. Apparently now are venting their own anger in protest. In Greece, even more protest that has to do more with austerity, less to do with freedom. But of course, it's protest none the like. It's revolutionaries coming together and using actions to change the way the government works. There's not much else I could say about this. I believe we've all kind of been beaten to a pulp with the news on this. But I think the most important thing to realize is that the world is not as simple as those academics once told us it would be. Now, we've been supporting these leaders in the Middle East for almost half a decade now. Half a century now. We've been continuing to support them with arms, military guns, contracts, whatever it may be. We saw them through the protests in Egypt. They were American-made tear gas cartridges they were throwing at the protesters. We have been supporting these people. Now, this is our government who has given qualms, has given support to the people in these governments, and they have been repressive of their people. And of course, they do deserve to fall because of this. But there's one thing that you must take away, is that there is no one way to handle any of this. People always ask, what will the United States do? What is the role of the United States? Should we have a no-fly zone over Libya, and should we enforce it and shoot planes down? Do these people not realize that it's our own intervention that has basically saddled these countries with the repressive regimes that they have? People must understand that in a world where a policeman is constantly intervening, all it shall do is spark more protest and more rage and more hate against us. Now, that's really all I have to say on that. There's many more we can go into. But hey, let's go into anarchy in our own United States of America. Off to Wisconsin.
An extraordinary turning point in Wisconsin tonight, where protests were already growing louder against the governor's cuts in pay and bargaining power for public workers. Well, today, supporters of the governor poured into the Capitol, coming face-to-face with the protesters in what's become a furious national debate over the unions and the leaders who now say we simply don't have the money anymore. Barbara Pinto leads us off in Madison tonight. Barbara, good evening.
Ain't got no cash.
Good evening, David. Another wild day here. More than 50,000 protesters, 500 police on this fifth day of demonstrations that were very loud, but mostly peaceful. This day, Capitol has become ground zero.
First, police in riot gear, and then the protesters.
This is what democracy looks like.
Tens of thousands of them, the biggest crowd yet, clogging the Capitol and the heart of this city. Most state workers angry over proposed budget cuts that slash benefits and cut at the heart of union power, the right to collective bargaining. Some are demanding a recall of the governor who just took office here 6 weeks ago.
We need a strong middle class, and that was built on the backs of unions.
And today, a smaller but equally passionate crowd supporting the governor, led by Tea Party activists, including Joe the Plumber.
Unions don't deserve anything. You don't deserve anything. You work for it yourself.
Small business owners Walt and Karen Nacido wanted their voices to be heard.
Public employees have been the Cadillac of employees, and it's got to stop.
We cannot continue this la-la land about paying union people so much money. There's going to be no America left.
Two union school teachers, two opposing views.
He's not busting the union.
If you take away.
If you believe that, I work for the university.
Did you hear?
I've worked for the university.
Did you hear?
No, I work for the university. I work for the university.
The unlikely epicenter of a national debate over who suffers most in states saddled with crippling deficits. More than a dozen are now targeting union workers and their benefits. Still on the lam here, the 14 Democratic senators who fled the state to stop the vote.
If they get one of us back there, then there's a quorum established, and we no longer have this ability to slow things down.
Clearly, the crowds here are very passionate. Today, there was talk of a compromise. Democratic lawmakers said they would give in on cuts to benefits if the governor would leave collective bargaining alone. The governor said no, so it looks like there is no end to all of this in sight. David?
Barbara Pinto, really something to see those two teachers there face-to-face. We thank you.
Okay, so now this is the basic argument, left versus right. That's the way the media is pinning this, and that's what the protesters ultimately believe. They see basically that Walker is a tool of corporate America, and he's coming to take away all of their rights. There's actually signs that have been put up that call him Scott Mubarak, which I have no clue how you can at all equate the two, but of course these people are believing their own fantasies. So what is at the heart of the issue here that has to do with collective bargaining, union rights, and of course the recession, budget shortfalls? The government does not have enough money. What does it do? It asked for concessions. Ask for small percentages. 5% of your salary be used for pension. A measly 12% be used for health care, just like the rest of us who work in the private sector. That's all that he is asking, and that's all he wanted to do. There's one thing he wanted to end, was that the stranglehold that union collective bargaining has when it's in negotiations with the government. Now, we've covered on this program a long time what happens when you pay your public employees more than private employees. And it's not about work is more important, or this or that, is that the money comes from somewhere. All public money comes from private individuals. So whenever you have exorbitant salaries for public employees, you have private employees who are suffering and are paying for those of the others. So they are subsidizing all the other workers. Now, I'm not saying that they don't have a legitimate grievance with the governor. I'm sure they do. Collective bargaining is not something that is ultimately bad, but it has come to the end, basically. The government in Wisconsin, just like most state governments, are facing huge cash shortfalls. No one has enough money to continue. And we all remember the articles. These are the same articles that I've pushed up, talking about how federal workers are earning double their private counterparts. That's two articles from USA Today. And the other one is federal pay ahead of private industry. Now, if you look at the annual wage for average people, the federal government workers normally make $67,000. State police is $60,000. Firefighters, $60,000. State government, $50,000. State legislative workers, $48,000. Government, all across the board, average is $47,000. And in the private sector, medium as well, $40,000. So we see the difference. You cannot sustain a system where you pay your public employees more than your private employees. Perhaps you can for a while if you have enough people, enough rich people who are willing to pay for it, but that is not the case, and is not the case, and the people voted in Scott Walker to change that, and he's doing his part. Is he going too far in some of his measures? Perhaps. But collective bargaining that he's trying to get rid of, how is only to do with health care and pension? Everything to do with salary is still left on the table. They're allowed to collective bargain as long as they want. Now, the important point of this is it's not pinning left versus right. It's the same thing that was happening in Greece. You have austerity cuts. You have government workers where basically one in four people worked for the government, and they're all having their pay reduced. Because that is what they have to do. They're shrinking money in the private sector, so it cannot finance the public sector as much. It's either they reform the salaries or basically raise taxes on everyone. And that has already been tried. It happened during the Great Depression, and what did it do? It prolonged the Great Depression until after 1945. Now, of course, there's going to be much argument about this, and many of you probably disagree with me on this point here, but people are out in the streets protesting. That is an important thing. They should be recognized, of course, and they have the right. It's not to say that they should be shut down. But on this issue, they're making it into something that they're not. The so-sorry left, as I call, these are the fake progressives who are in the elite media positions, such as Paul Krugman, paint this as another people versus the corporations type of argument. And that's not at all what it is. But of course, that's what's continually being portrayed. Well, that is enough. We have many more to talk about that. It's also happening in Ohio. You have government workers coming out and protesting. I mean, basically, the fact is that money is going to have to come from somewhere. Unions have had a lot of power. I believe anybody would make that point, would declare that, would concede to that. And now is the time, perhaps, to look at the books. That's all. That's all it is. Look at the books and see what can be done. Of course, that's just one of our little tidbits, one of our stories. And I think I'd like to transition over just a wee bit and talk about our former leaders. Now, these are our former leaders. I say leaders, that's in quotes. It has to do with the United States of America and the people who were in power and brought our countries to war back in the day. Here's Donald Rumsfeld. Apparently has a new book out trying to make the media feel. Let's see what he's saying.
Nice to see you. Hi there. Good to see you. Greetings, greetings.
We took Rumsfeld to the Pentagon, and it's clear walking the 17 miles of hall. Here,
sir, my uncle used to work for you.
He's the stuff of legend. At one point, we stop. These are artists' portraits of 300 of the faces of so many fallen.
Each one a different life, different circumstance. Yeah, God bless him.
Yeah. I ask him, what about something another Secretary of Defense once said? It was Robert McNamara, the architect of Vietnam.
Any military commander who is honest with you will say he's made mistakes which have cost lives.
Well, you're dealing with lives. There's no question if a mistake is made by you or anyone else, it can contribute to the loss of life. That's the nature of it. It is a very difficult thing to ask people to go into battle.
Is it hard to live with?
I have so much respect for the men and women in uniform that they're all volunteers. They all ask to serve.
All volunteers.
Each one said, send me. I think the world's a better place with Saddam Hussein gone and with the Taliban gone and the Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan.
There we go. That's what he tried to put in. And the Al-Qaeda out of What country are we now? Afghanistan. Even though, why are we still there? Why did we go to Iraq? It had nothing to do with anything but to get rid of Saddam, apparently. Well, that's one. But let us hear a little bit about what he has to say on Gitmo. That's another interesting thing. If you were to catch Osama bin Laden today, where would he put them? And what about all those little young rascals who are stuck in Gitmo right now?
Are you comfortable with the notion that people that were picked up on the battlefield in Iraq or Afghanistan in 2001, 2002 could live their lives in Guantanamo Bay with a prison without ever seeing the inside of a courtroom, be it military or civilian? Is that okay with you?
Oh, goodness, none of it's okay with me.
Oh, goodness.
You know, no one wants to be the jailer for the world. I don't know that they necessarily would have to stay there the rest of their lives. Some could be sent back to their home countries to be handled there. Other cases, they could have a military commission try them and come to a judgment. They
Kangaroo
might come to
court.
A judgment that they, like happens in our civilian courts, that it was a mistake and they shouldn't have been there.
Oh!
It breaks your heart if that's the case, but it happens.
Let me ask you, if you were still defense secretary and if bin Laden were caught, what would you do with him?
Oh my goodness, I think he'd probably end up in Guantanamo Bay. I think he'd probably be subjected to a military commission.
And then?
And who knows what the military commission would decide. He has brought enormous harm to the world.
What?
Just out of curiosity, if we did catch him, he's down at Guantanamo Bay Prison. Would you like to go down there and see him?
No.
Really?
No.
I he's not my type.
He's not my type. Okay, so Rumsfeld is saying that bin Laden has caused so much trouble around the world. I mean, he's the one who's mounted all of these drones and killed thousands of people in Pakistan, who's mounted these drones and killed millions of people in Iraq and Afghanistan. Pakistan, Waziristan, going back and forth between the stands. We've killed thousands of people. That's not Osama bin Laden who's done that. What has he done? Oh, that's right. He flew the tower. He flew the planes into the tower. He's the one who did that. Does that justify all of this killing, all of these wars, all of these millions of lives and billions and trillions of dollars that have been spent? Who is profiting? Follow the money. That's the only question to truly ask. But let me ask one question. If we were to catch bin Laden tomorrow, put him in Gitmo, is the whole thing over? Can we stop all the invasions, all the insurrections? Can we stop that? Can we bring every single troop home? Could we stop the police state at home? Could we repeal the Patriot Act? Can we get rid of that? Can we get rid of all military police powers acts? Can we do that? Is that what's going to happen? Of course not, and it never will happen, because Osama bin Laden shall never be found. If anything, he's been dead in Pakistan, and if he is found dead, that will not help the government's case. All it'll prove is that it's all been a waste, and it's all been a big, big joke. Speaking of jokes, hilarious jokes. We had our former Vice President Dick Cheney go before the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, and try to give a speech, and he gets so many people are praising him and they're clapping. Oh goodness, it's so amazing.
Mercy. All right, sit down and shut up.
Shut up, you slaves. Shut up, slave.
War criminals!
The usual spirited exercise.
Okay, wasn't that amazing? Being called a war criminal, if only I had been there myself. But you hear the drones in the very beginning. You hear these zombies.
USA! USA! USA!
I mean, this man single-handedly took away more of your freedoms than you will ever know. And here you are, cheering him on, screaming USA. Whoever screamed the war criminal, you get a pat on the back in my book, my friend. Way to go. And of course, we'll have more about this one man, about Rumsfeld, about the entire Iraq war and justification and the lies that brought us to it. And it's now admitted fully in the media it was all a lie. But of course, that's how it goes. We'll be right back here on Liberty in Exile after this tune. Cake, love you madly. Alright, now, biggest story on this show today, right now, biggest story, pay attention, open those ears, those brains must be wide open, let it resonate upon the hills and come down from this voice. There is one story that is more important than all of them, that has been presented today, that shall be presented for the next week, that shall be presented in the past month. This does not have to do with revolution in the Middle East, but it does have to do with our entire justification for being there continually until today. Roll the clip, please.
I want you to stand by because we want you to weigh in on another story and bring in our Brian Todd now. This is a story about an informant who supplied information used to justify the invasion of Iraq. He now says flatly that he lied. Brian Todd has been working on this. Brian, what are you finding out?
Well, Candy, as you remember, this man's intelligence was a pillar in the Bush administration's case to wage what turned out to be a devastating war in Iraq. When you look back to those days of very intense debate, this latest admission is even more jarring.
So here it is. They're coming out and saying it right to your face. It was all a lie. He lied, he lied. It was all a lie. Based on lies, lie, lie, lie. Obama took us out, though, didn't he? Oh, that's right. There's still 50,000 troops there. Oops.
Just weeks before shock and awe, a definitive-sounding statement from the Bush administration. It had sound intelligence that justified going to war with Iraq.
We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels. The source was an eyewitness, an Iraqi chemical engineer who supervised one of these facilities.
That source came to be known as Curveball. His real name, Rafid Ahmed Alwan Al-Janabi. Now he tells the British newspaper The Guardian he made everything up.
Were all those things lies?
Yes.
Al-Janabi, who also gave an on-camera interview to The Guardian, was asked why he sold a complete fabrication to German intelligence.
I had to do something for my country, so I did this and I am satisfied because there is no dictator in Iraq anymore.
But a journalist who's reported on Curveball's credibility problems says that, too, is a lie.
I'm speaking with Bob Drogan from the L.A. Times. His newspaper broke this story, and Bob wrote a book on Curveball in 2007. He's joining us on the phone from Cairo. Bob, why did Curveball tell this story in the first place?
He told the story because he wanted to get out of a refugee camp in Germany. He wanted to get on the payroll of the German intelligence agency. He wanted to get his wife out and bring them to Germany, and he wanted to get citizenship, and he wanted a Mercedes-Benz, and he got all of those things.
So let me get this straight. We have lost 4,439 American lives, 4,757 lives in total. These are just Western powers, not counting all the civilians killed for a Mercedes-Benz, a Visa, and a couple of $100,000. That's the reason, that's why, that's our own exchange. If anyone still gives credibility to government and to military prowess, they themselves should be denounced now.
According to intelligence sources, right, Curveball told the German intelligence agency before the war that Saddam Hussein had a secret biological weapons program. The Germans had reservations about his credibility. They never granted the CIA direct access to Curveball.
I asked the chief of the German station here in Washington. He said, no, we're not going to give you access to it. And don't ask. It'll cause too much trouble.
But the analysis of Curveball's information did make its way through U.S. intelligence. There were tense internal debates over its credibility. Enough analysts thought it plausible that it made its way into Colin Powell's speech at the U.N. and became a key component of the Bush administration's case for a war that has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives.
And the key players in this drama still feel the sting of all this. Responding to Curveball's admission that he lied, former Secretary of State Colin Powell sent us a statement saying it's been known for years that Curveball was unreliable, but that we should ask the CIA and other agencies why that wasn't put in their intelligence estimates before those estimates were sent to him and President Bush. George Tenet, CIA director at the time, says concerns about Curveball didn't get disseminated far and wide through the agency as they should have been, and that he wasn't alerted to those concerns. President Bush's office would not comment. We did not hear back from Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld's offices, or from the German intelligence agency. Candy?
And Brian, you've been, you've picked up more on what Curveball's been doing and more recently, which makes his credibility erode even more than it already is.
Yeah, we sure did. Curveball went back to Iraq. He tried to run for parliament, but he was branded non-credible by other politicians there. He is now back in Germany. Bob Drogan, that author, says he's had a series of jobs at places like fast food restaurants, but he's gotten fired from those places for lying.
Okay, let me get this straight now. So the man who told us 100% that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction is now working in burger joints. Getting fired from burger joints. Even that. So here we are. That's your flame-grilled WMD. You want cheese on that? Tomatoes? Extra 50 cents. Just to think of it. A government source for an entire invasion of war. And he's reduced to working at a fast food restaurant, flipping burgers happily like the downtrodden among us. Now, of course, you can't place the blame 100% on Senor Curveball, which by his own name kind of... doesn't it kind of give the impression that what he's giving you isn't going to be the straight fact? Anyway, it doesn't matter. But you can't blame this one individual. What did he want? He wanted a Mercedes-Benz. He wanted a salary and a visa. That's what he wanted, and he surely got it. But you just have to look at our own government and how basically incompetent they are. But of course, this has nothing to do with incompetence. It has to do with basically malevolence. It has to do with them purposefully using this as a justification. They needed any justification. They didn't really care. They had their hearts and minds set on this invasion from the very beginning. So it does not matter. We can't blame Curveball directly, but our government, of course, in our name, goes abroad and kills hundreds of thousands of people, lest we allow it to continue. So, therefore, we do call for the end of the American Empire and see where death doth bring us. And there are amazing other stories that we have to cover that have to do with this in this realm. There's actually a couple of things having to do with war. I call this section War is Peace, because basically we've been in war so long that it is the new peacetime. There's a new article here, of course, that comes from the Huffington Post talking about how the Afghan conflict has ramped up so much in the past 2 years. Drone strikes are at their maximum. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is saying that they have to try to split Al-Qaeda from the Taliban. And now there's, in the New Yorker, it came out that we've been in direct talks with the Taliban now for 2 years. The entire reason we're in Afghanistan. And other things you could sort of cover there. I mean, it's pretty depressing after a while. You keep looking at the news, you keep trying to spread the information, look at all of the things, but there are interests, strategic interests, that are above our comprehension and above our control. But what can we do? We can bring these news to other people, and hopefully this information shall resonate, and perhaps it'll get people to change their minds and withdraw their support. Never should you vote for a war candidate. That's why Obama got elected. He was not a war candidate. He was an anti-war candidate, and that's why he got elected. And where does that bring us now? More warfare. And it continues. But let's sort of transition away from that. I have a subject here called Canuck versus the United States. There are a couple of stories that have kind of been pushed out in the last 2 months or so, having to do with the border between the United States and Canada. Now, going back and forth as often as I do, I often see border security. I see what it's like. I believe I've taken the airplanes, I've done the Greyhound, I've taken the train, done everything basically but walked. And I see the security apparatus, I see how it works, I see how amazingly stupid and ridiculous it is on the American side, and lax and pretty much fairly amazing on the Canadian side. That's exactly how it is. But a couple of stories where there's in the Ottawa Citizen, this came out at the beginning of February, where apparently Joe Lieberman is going to start calling for visa applications for Canadians who want to visit the United States. Now, I wrote up a little piece on this on libertyinexile.com. You can read it there, as well as any of the articles and videos that we've covered here on this program. But he's basically been trying to push for strengthening our border security with Canada. And of course, this is just it. This is the paranoid arm of government that does not know what to do and just is trying to protect every single one of its citizens. It gets pretty paranoid and says, okay, well now, if you want to cross the border, you're going to need visas. There we are. If you thought it was a pain just going back and forth today, just wait until tomorrow. Now, of course, this is ridiculous for a number of reasons, but it's fairly obvious, you would say. There are 100 million people who cross the border each and every day, and practically every single one of them are done by peaceful, lawful citizens of either country. Now, it must be understood that they do not travel across the border to commit crimes or to incite terror, but what they're doing is they're engaging in commerce and free movement, as they're allowed to do, and they should do, and we need them to do. And to honestly propose that each one of these peaceful citizens get documented permission from either country ahead of time is both preposterous and ludicrous. No common sense involved at all. Now, this would disrupt billions of dollars in trades, and it's just basically a ridiculous and a stupid idea. But talking about Canada and the United States, there are other stories that sort of have flown under the radar. This is coming from Canada.com, having to do with integration of our militaries. This is an article from the 22nd of February. Canada and the U.S. have signed an agreement that paves the way for the militaries from either nation to send troops across each other's borders during an emergency, but some are questioning why the Harper government, that's in Canada, has kept silent on the deal. Neither the Canadian government nor the Canadian forces announced the new agreement, which was signed February 14th in Texas. And you can read the rest of the article on libertyinexile.com, but this is just the same thing. It's the militarization of the police force, integrating the military, trying to basically forge together some sort of North American union that would rival what we have here in Europe right now, the United States of Europe. And there we are. There's a couple of crazy stories that I could throw out about the Hollywood star whackers. Randy Quaid is running from them in Hollywood, and he's been granted asylum, finally, in, I believe he's in British Columbia. And, I mean, if you want more background on this Randy Quaid story, you just have to look it up. I don't really think it's that pertinent to Liberty and Exile, but it's very interesting. Hollywood star whackers, elite groups of lawyers and basically marketing publicists who want to try to get this guy out of all the millions that he has. Well, who knows what will happen. But let's get into the funner part of Liberty and Exile. I think that's why most people try to listen. Of course, we're all here to have fun. Let's talk about some amazingly fun times. Of course, I'm in Europe studying on my own, and one thing that I think every single college-aged individual normally does, attend to parties, and yes, at times they do happen to have a little bit of alcohol, but let us see how this is changing in states across the Union.
Turn now to Sue Schallenberger, who has a very interesting column out that basically suggests, well, most of us might have wanted free drinks at college. There are some people, and perhaps a growing number, who want drink-free college. Sue, it's fascinating. Sounds nothing like my college. Tell us about it.
A growing number of campuses are trying to curb binge drinking problems by starting up no alcohol activities, from roller skating and foam dances to tailgate parties with no booze. It's a trend.
Look, where I'm from, sober college is an oxymoron. You talk to some of the kids who are actually participating in this, and what do they say? I mean, are they getting the same things out of their party experience that other kids are getting?
A very typical experience is that non-drinking kids will start some of these events and invite their campus friends. The friends are initially skeptical, but when they get there and the activities are planned and they're having a great time, free food, party atmosphere, many of them say, hey, I had more fun than I expected. I could do this again. And that's the whole idea. The idea is to give kids an alternative to drinking, which takes up so much time on so many campuses from Thursday through Saturday nights.
Now, these are on campuses that previously weren't booze-free, if you like, and there have, for a long time in the U.S., been campuses that have been drink-free and some caffeine-free, like Brigham Young University.
That's right. There are more than a handful of colleges and universities around the country that, usually for religious reasons, have their students sign a pledge not to drink, drug, even drink coffee. Those pledges are kept to varying degrees. I mean, alcohol sometimes seeps onto those campuses as well. They're in the minority, though, for sure.
Okay, very, very sobering. Thank you very much, Sue Schallenberger in Portland, Oregon.
You know, Simon, one thing about that story was
that... thirsty?
No, but they said the kids who didn't drink said they didn't like to miss classes in the morning. I didn't even know there were classes.
Wow, fascinating. It sounds like we need a drink.
Sounds like we need a drink. Now, whatever you may think of that study, I think it's quite interesting. The news anchors there pretty much paint themselves as raving alcoholics, but hey, that's neither here nor there. Another interesting little clip coming from CBS having to do with what would you give up to be skinny. Now, there's one part that I must mention here. There's an interesting story, and you know, there are many more of these that have to do with women's self-image, men's self-image, and the self-image of teenagers today, and what that's changing. And I believe it's very important for understanding the mental health of our own society. Now, there's a documentary I believe you should all see called Star Suckers. It talks about this, how everyone wants to be famous, look good, want to be known, and everything. And it's basically a disease, and it's very entrenched. It's very well done and well weaved into our own society and basically everything that is around us. I mean, just imagine the people who talk to you about Jersey Shore and all of these ridiculous and stupid reality shows that have nothing to do with anything and are all about filming someone else's life that's not yours. Anyway, but go on. I want you to watch Star Suckers, and then you'll understand this story and understand what I'm talking about here. Now, this is coming from CBS, and do pay attention.
Would you give up sex to be thin? Well, Fitness Magazine asked 2,400 women if they would sacrifice a full year of sex to be skinny, and 51% said yes. That was just one of the surprising results of the magazine's new diet survey, which underscored the serious self-esteem and body issues many women have today. And here to discuss the results is early show contributor and psychologist, Dr. Jennifer Hartstein. Dr. Hartstein, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And this study, you know, this 51% of women who say they'll give it up, what does that say about body image among women?
Well, it really says a lot about body image. In fact, another study that I saw yesterday said 61% of women are thinking about what their body looks like while they're having sex. So clearly, we are so focused on appearance, and we're bombarded with images of what our appearance should look like, how thin we should be, how tall we should be, what we should be wearing. It's everywhere. So it's not really surprising that it's the thing that women think about the most, but the things they would give up in order to achieve this ideal is, I think, what's really surprising in the study.
How tied to sex itself and the images that you see in the media do you think this image issue is?
Okay, cut this. I can't stand this anymore. Yeah, okay. I just thought it was a little interesting tidbit. That's what people are really talking about now in the news, and well, that's the state of our society. But let us delve back into the great issues of the day that have to do with, of course, the government lying to us. But this has to do with, well, let's talk about drugs. Why not? We are advocates of legalization on this program, both for economic reasons and basically the good of society as a whole. We've had prohibition now of marijuana and other drugs for too long. We see the violence in Mexico as a result. We see what's going on there. And the second you make something illegal, you basically create the incentive to trade it on the black market and to use violence to protect your profits. Now, let us cover one story. This is coming from Fox News. Now, I'm convinced that Fox News is totally against all types of drugs and really is... I'm going to sort of blame them a little bit for Prop 19 in California, which would have legalized marijuana, because I believe Fox News had a big part in that. They basically drummed up their social conservatives and these people who get upset by stupid issues, and, you know, marijuana legalization was the latest one of the day. And this has to do with basically smoking marijuana at the wheel. At the wheel. Basically making it to where you can be under the influence, and you'll be called, it'll be just like if you're under the influence of alcohol, and they'll have a measurement of THC. This is in Colorado they're talking about doing this. Let's listen to this report. This is coming from Fox News with that hellion Gretchen.
Welcome back, everyone. Soon you may be able to get a DUI in Colorado, but not because you're too drunk, but too high to drive. Two lawmakers are proposing a bill that would limit the amount of medical marijuana drivers may legally have in their blood while driving. If passed, Colorado would join Nevada, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, which already enforce THC limits.
What? Do you know that?
Here to explain is Colorado State Representative Mark Waller, who's co-sponsoring this bipartisan bill.
Ooh, bipartisan.
From Denver.
That means it's good.
Good morning.
All right, so you have come up with this bipartisan bill, and you think it's
bipartisan,
right?
Absolutely. This bill comes out of the Criminal Justice Commission in the state of Colorado.
All right, so you are trying to set a limit. How do you come up with the actual limit of somebody who's too high to be behind the wheel?
You smoke it.
Well, the subject matter experts have looked at this and determined that 5 nanograms is the appropriate level to
the experts.
At which you could presume somebody is under the influence of marijuana. But that is a rebuttable presumption. So if somebody's charged with driving under the influence of marijuana, because they're over that 5 nanogram level, they could conceivably go into court and prove that they're not under the influence of marijuana.
Mm-hmm. So it would be a similar situation to driving under the influence of alcohol. I would assume that drivers could refuse to take the blood test, et cetera, like they can with alcohol. But 1 in 5 accidents currently in your state have to do with people who are high?
What? Where is this coming from?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that number goes up every day as we have more and more and more medical marijuana users in the state of Colorado. We have actually over 100,000 medical marijuana users currently in the state of Colorado. And while it might be legal to smoke marijuana or use marijuana for medicinal purposes,
yeah,
it's still against the law to drive under the influence.
Right. So what happens now? Because it's illegal currently in the state of Colorado to drive under the influence of anything. So what happens when a police officer pulls over somebody and they think that they're high?
You stoned.
Well, a police officer would pull somebody over, and if they have probable cause to believe that they're under the influence of marijuana, they would ask them to take a chemical test, a blood test, to determine what their nanogram level is. If it's over 5 nanograms of THC in their system, then they'd be charged with driving under the influence of marijuana. But again, that's a rebuttable presumption, so they could go to court and try to prove that they weren't under the influence of 5 nanograms.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. And why did you decide that this issue was so important to you?
He's stoned.
Well, again, we have over 100,000 medical marijuana patients using marijuana in the state of Colorado now. The accident rate's going up. As in regards to people who use marijuana, and it's certainly a significant public safety issue.
What kind of blowback have you had, if any? Because it is a bipartisan bill.
Bipartisan.
Well, and I think we've been getting a little bit of pushback from some folks in the marijuana industry saying
industry.
We don't want people driving under the influence of marijuana, but that 5 nanogram level, it's too low.
Mm-hmm. Too
so
low.
So do you believe that there's this correlation with more people driving under the influence and the legality of medical marijuana?
Oh, here it comes. Fox News wants it illegal.
Oh, certainly. As access in the state grows, the more users of marijuana, whether they're legal or illegal, is going to grow, and that means more people on the streets driving their cars under the influence.
Yeah, we saw stunning video coming out of California a few months ago. I don't know if you caught that, where they set up, they had 2 journalists actually get high and then drive to see if they were as impaired as when you drink alcohol, and the video was startling. So you are representative from Colorado, Mark Waller, and thank you so much for sharing what your bill is all about.
Oh, thank you. That was amazing.
Coming up on our show.
Yo, coming up next, you're here live on Fox.
So there are plenty of things you can pull out from that clip. You hear bipartisan, you hear that word all the time, and our brains have sort of been manipulated into thinking if something is bipartisan, if there's someone from the Democratic Party and someone from the Republican Party, someone from the left, someone from the right who agree on it, that must mean it should be good for everyone, which is always a total lie. The support for all the wars is always bipartisan. All these police state bills is always bipartisan. Anything to take away your rights is always bipartisan. What else is there to pick up? Well, basically the whole THC limit. You have experts testing this out. I mean, is it expert Doobie Steve who's, puts on a lab coat? He's like, dude, just like 3 joints. That's the limit. Who came up with these studies? Where are his numbers coming from? The study that there are more car accidents. I mean, he didn't give one little figure. He didn't, cite a report, a poll, nothing. This is all opinion. It's all just, 2 Republicans on TV talking back and forth about why this substance should be illegal. That's the only thing going on here. All right, and this is the waste of time, and that's what basically goes on the airwaves of Fox News nowadays. Now, I have an article bashing Fox News on my website, libertyinexile.com. You'll find it there. You'll find all the descriptions, the information, and hopefully one day we'll basically turn the tides, but we shall see in the time right now. Now, the subjects that I had on today's little marker and, of course, on my little notes, here I had claimed into Webb's Lying in War, which Revolutionaries of the World Unite. War is peace. Canuck versus the United States. Terror theater. The police state. Union protests. Ban devil drugs. The bankers rule you. Sexy. And much more. And you'll find the notes at libertyinexile.com. I'll have all the information there. You can kind of double check me, make sure I'm not trying to lie to you as well, because basically government authorities do it enough. Why would I do it too? So other things kind of covered. Terror theater. There was another perhaps bomber that they found maybe trying to kill George Bush. He had his address, and apparently he tried to buy stuff off Amazon. We don't really know. We don't really have the information yet, but automatically the guy is totally guilty. Yeah, of course, send him to prison. There you are. Jury, judge, executioner, dead. That's how the justice system works. Let's just get into a little bit of police state news before we call it a show here. This has to do with criminalizing childhood, which has been a theme on this show for a while. It's basically that, you know, when we're children, we're now being set up in the same standards as adults. It's sort of like the police state is reaching down and supposed to encapsulate the children, too. Now, this is a report coming from Fox, a local Fox affiliate. See what you think it has to do with drawing stick figures and then going to prison.
An 11-year-old following orders from his therapist, only to be cuffed, arrested, and hauled off to jail. Nightside's Julie Hayden has the story you'll see only on Fox.
Libby, this boy's parents and doctors don't understand why Arvada police treated an 11-year-old the way they did. Now, his parents don't want us to use their real names or show their faces. 11-year-old Tim was only doing what his therapist told him to do.
We will often ask kids to draw about their feelings.
Tim is being treated for ADD, and his therapist told him to draw pictures when he got upset rather than disrupt class. So that's what he did. Last October, Tim drew a stick figure of himself with a gun, pointed at four other stick figures with the words, "Teachers must die."
It was what his doctors had told him was the right thing to do.
He felt calmer and was throwing it away when his teacher saw it and sent him to the principal's office. Now, the school determined Tim wasn't a threat, notified his parents, and sent him back to class. But his mom was horrified when Arvada police showed up that night, arrested her son, and hauled him away in handcuffs.
It was heart-wrenching to see my son walk out my front door, my 11-year-old son walk out my front door in handcuffs and get in that police car.
Police put Tim in a cell, took his mugshot, fingerprinted him, and wouldn't let him see his parents. He says he thought he was going to jail and never going home again.
I think it's violently unfair to these little guys, and it's traumatic.
According to the police report, the school at first said it did not want to press charges, and Tim told officers he would never hurt teachers or anyone. A juvenile assessment report shows he's never been in legal trouble before and is at low risk to reoffend. But he's being charged with interfering with staff and students at an educational facility. The system says it's doing what's in the best interest of the child. But Tim's therapist says handcuffing him and putting him in a cell does much more harm than good.
I really don't get that at all. I mean, to me, it doesn't seem like there's any victim to this. He was doing what he thought he should. He's only 11. He's not posing a serious threat to anybody. I mean, that just is bizarre to me that they'd respond this way.
Now, Arvada says because today is a holiday, they were not able to get hold of everyone involved or pull all the reports, but they will have a response tomorrow. For Nightside, I'm Julie Hayden, Fox 39.
All right, let's put those kids in jail. You have an 11-year-old who's drawing weird pictures. Prison is where he belongs. He needs to be with those old gangsters and murderers and racketeers. That's where we need to put him, is in prison. Isn't that amazing? Childhood becoming criminalized. You know, and the Japanese have laughed about this, you know, for a long time, because in America we do have the largest prison population. You know, that's accounting for everything, accounting for the actual population and accounting for percentage-wise. We have more people in our prisons than anywhere else in the world. There we are, winners once again. Celebration, cheering. Thank you, there we are. Huge prison population. And just the latest story, and we hear this every single day. More times than not, people are being brought and carried off to prison. If you used to have a fight in school, well, you used to go to detention, but now the police arrive and you're arrested and you're summoned in court. Because that's what we do. Our children, our childhood, we're all criminals now. Ah, there we go. That's the changing tide. And, of course, I'll have all the other articles and a couple of things I didn't get to. There's some GPS tracking going on in Los Angeles. Apparently, students that are tardy to class, if they're taught, if they have four or more absences or four or more tardies, apparently they have a GPS device that they must carry. This is coming from CBS Los Angeles. This is an article from the 18th of February. Let's read from the article just to kind of see what it's about. Call it a last-ditch effort to tackle truancy in Orange County. Two Anaheim schools have become the first in California to adopt GPS tracking to prevent students from cutting class. Students with at least four unexcused absences will be given a handheld device with a GPS signal to verify their location, which officials hope will cut down on truancies. Anaheim School District Director of Safe Schools Rick Martins said participating students will be required to check in electronically 5 times a day by entering a text message. Well, hey kids, you get to text message at school, but you have to check in with the police state. You have to check in with Big Brother to make sure you are at school. Now, if anyone does not see the violation in this, then they themselves don't know the world that is growing around them. Where else shall we allow this to continue? Story after story after story that we present here is about criminalizing childhood. It's about the police state being brought into the schools. I mean, this spans back from 1967 when they had the Supreme Court ruling that basically there are no constitutional rights for students at school. Ever since then, it's been the same story again and again. Now, we have some banking stories. Madoff came out, said the banks had to know about the scheme. That's really not a surprise. Countrywide financial chief apparently had his charges dropped. Big surprise. Freddie Mac is asking for $500 million more dollars. Huge surprise there. On the social front, of course, Barack Obama is sort of dithering still on his don't ask, don't tell. And there's an entire article from New York Times talking about how, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but don't ask, don't tell did not actually end, and that it is still in action, and if you are gay, openly in the military, you shall be discharged. Wow, 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 wow. But of course, we have to be hopeful. We have to be hopeful because it is a time to be hopeful. On Liberty in Exile, from the very beginning, we've covered stories that, well, attempt to help you educate yourself, educate your day, and help you see the world in a new light. This analysis, this commentary, this media assassination is put out there to help you, to make days better, not worse, to make smiles bigger, and not turned upside down. That's what we shall continue to do here at Liberty in Exile. I'm your host, Yael Lasoski. I'm reporting to you, of course, from Die Freiheit Studio in Wien, Österreich, in the United States of Europe. We'll be back next week. More news, more analysis on our website, as always, is there as well. And to all of you, au revoir, et bonne chance à tous.